Hey people, welcome to a special episode of Diaspora Asia Podcast. This is our first episode that we're doing in English.
Yeah, and we don't do it from here, from our studio, quote unquote. But Zina organized a fantastic event. That there was a panel on. Maybe you want to say a little bit more about the event you organized for Asian Diaspora Month?
Yeah, sure. So May was Asian Diaspora Month. And I was a bit sad that I was super busy and that I couldn't go to any events because all of the events were in Berlin. We're outside, by the way, so now you're hearing the church bells. So, yeah. So I thought that I should organize something here so that we have something here, because we always have like this problem that everything is in Berlin and like other smaller cities don't have this kind of events for groups that are like marginalized within marginalized group, I would say. I actually wanted to organize more than one event, but it was too much workload. So only one. And I did a film screening. I invited the Chinese director, Po Fan, to show his documentary that is called Papa Rainbow. It's about queer kids in China and their parents or their fathers, and like how their stories are connected in like how the kids came out to them and how the parents first struggled with this and but then later came around and started supporting the kids and also got politically involved in doing work for LGBTQ in China. And it's a really beautiful documentary. And then I thought, okay, so but now we have like only one event in Frankfurt and the perspective is very much like East Asian Chinese dominated, and we already have the problem of like when we have like events in relation to like Asian whatever stuff, that it's most of the time East Asian dominated. So I thought, okay, we need to add something. So I want to do a panel where we talk about queer Asian perspectives and where we have a lot of different queer Asian perspectives and that are not like only East Asian perspectives and more also diaspora perspectives.
Mm. Yeah, how was this event for you in the end? Like moderating the panel and seeing all the perspective that everybody will hear in a bit?
Yeah, I was super nervous about it. It was the first time to moderate something like this, and also in English. And yeah, and I wasn't sure who was going to come, because I feel like this topic is really, yeah, like not many people are interested in that, who don't have this like betroffene Perspektive. How to say that in English? Mm-hmm. I don't know. So, yeah, because it's not only like Asian perspectives, but also queer Asian perspectives. And I was kind of hoping to have like, because this event was one where I felt like a lot of allies could learn something. So mm-hmm. I was also hoping for that the people who see themselves as allies would come and kind of get educated on topics like that. But it was really nice. It was really fun. And also that we all went to have Chinese barbecue afterwards. And I've kind of felt like this is probably the first time to have a panel like this in Frankfurt. I kind of felt super revolutionary. I don't know. Probably there was something like this and I just missed it, or I wasn't here yet. I don't always want to say that this was a first to make something sound super great, because I actually don't know if it was a first.
I also really enjoyed it from a spectator's perspective. Dan was there, and you will all hear Dan twice this month in our podcast, because we have this episode. The next episode will be our birthday episode, and the last one will be about queerness, but more specifically about love and
dating relationships,
sex, whatever.
Boundaries.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. Basically what you all were interested in, because you could ask us questions. We have so many questions that you asked. Mm-hmm. And we're definitely going to do another one with this constellation, so with Dan, and also we had another guest, Kitty, but you will hear it soon. So first, yeah, we are going to publish this episode, then there's going to be our birthday episode, and then the next queer Asian episode. Yeah, I would say that's enough from us for now.
Oh, two more things. I think first we want to apologize for the quality of audio.
Oh yeah,
it was super spontaneous, but we still thought it would be worth sharing and that the people interested in it would maybe enjoy the content despite the bad quality of the audio. It's really, really bad.
Mm.
It's just my phone really far away from the speakers. And yeah, for I was named as a person to sit on the panel, but after the movie, and you all will hear about my relationship status and everything else that is kind of affiliated with my queerness. In the last episode this month. So yeah, after the movie, and the movie was super intense, and I thought my life reality was really far away from it. So I decided not to sit on the panel, but just to be a spectator and ask the questions I had, and I don't regret this this decision. It was super, super nice, and I don't think I could have said anything people on the panel didn't say, and yeah, really enjoyed listening.
Still believe you had probably lots of beautiful thoughts to add, but next time or next episode. Okay, enjoy and yeah, share it with people. I don't know. I really hope the audio is good enough for you to listen to it, but you will see. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So to my right is Popo Fun, who directed the documentary you just saw. I first saw it at the Asian Film Festival, I think, 2 years ago. And really, I was crying the whole time because it's just such an amazing piece of work. And it's really, I really felt so many things as a queer kid coming from a family of Taiwanese immigrants. And this really means so much to me and to so many people. And I really saw like so many people crying in the audience this time as well. Thank you so much for your work. Popo is not only an amazing person, but also a writer and a comedian. In October, we shared the stage at the Voicemail event in Berlin. It was an event for Asians to perform spoken word, comedy, and music. And it was really hilarious. I loved it. And on this side, we have Dan. I think I met you two at the Pride Parade last year, right? The first time. I think I already knew of you, but then it was actually the first time we met.
Yeah.
And I think that was going to be there, right?
We met here the first time, ever?
No, I think you came in the end of the Pride Parade and you just took the train.
Oh, yeah! I'm sorry, yeah. Your hair was greener then?
Yeah, it was. So Ram is an activist, a writer, makeup artist, style icon. Every time I see you, I'm like, wow, you look so fabulous. And this is Dan. Dan is also a spoken word artist, really beautiful spoken word. And you're like my hero of radical softness. Really, I learned so much from you. Like talking about struggles, talking about mental health. It's really amazing what you do. So I prepared a few questions, and then I thought we can open the discussion for questions from the audience. So as this event is part of Asian Diaspora Month, I wanted to know what Asian Diaspora Month means for you, if you attended any events, and how is this month going for you all?
This month is actually a struggle because I think it's not just Asian Diaspora Month, it's also like Masturbation Month or something, and it's also like Lupus Awareness Month, and I have lupus, by the way. But yeah, I don't know, Asian Diaspora Month, I'm missing the time to really process what it means for me. Yeah, and I haven't been home this month, so I don't know, I would like to have more time with my parents and family to talk about this, but yeah, at the moment I don't even want to call my mom. Yeah, so
for me, coming from not like as in the whole wide world with us, like my kind is not very much like visualized as Asian, so we didn't like get a lot of Asian diaspora moments for us to claim. So I didn't feel anything about it. I attended some panel events, but like I don't even know that we know that it's Asian diaspora month. Like I knew because of you guys. But I don't think that a lot of Tamil people do know that it's Asian diaspora month, and they also don't like to claim it because they feel like as a minority, they're a very special minority. So they don't want to be in a big, big minorities because they are like afraid of their problems being diluted and stuff. Yeah, so that's why I think this might be my first.
For me, I didn't know about it until I got invited to for this screening in Frankfurt, so it's very special. But it's been a busy month for me, and I have deadline even until this weekend. Actually, the end of the month, so I'm very stressful, especially working, so I didn't sleep very much before I come to Frankfurt, so that's why I'm a little bit sick and not so energetic today. Let's see, but this Asian diaspora might give me some energy.
Yeah, it really, like always the problem is that all the events are taking place in Berlin. Like, I wanted one to be here, so I had to organize it myself. And I feel like this is like a problem we have, that like everything is in Berlin and we need more structures, we need more community and more resources to organize things like this and have more of the community.
I mean, I think Asian Diaspora Month is not so popular here also because it's a very American thing, I think.
Is it?
Yes, because I've seen a lot of events like in the US, but not necessarily here. Because I don't know, it's just more. There's just more Asian diaspora in the US, so it's kind of obvious.
I also think that like certain diasporas are stronger because they have more structures, infrastructure. They have schools. They have all these kinds of things, and that's not the case in Germany. So that's why I believe like it's also, if you go to like UK or somewhere, there are more people and more structures, and they have more institutions which they use in a daily basis, and where they're confronted with their beings of Asian, and that's not the case here. You know, that's why I think we have a lesser Asian diaspora visibility.
So for the context why it's called Asian Diaspora Month here, because it's called Asian Pacific Islander Heritage Month in the US. And when I was organizing this, I wasn't sure which one to pick because I saw like all the events that are taking place in Berlin, that they chose Asian Diaspora Month. And then I talked to her from orientation, I talked about it a bit, and she said that I decided it to be Asian Diaspora Month because to highlight the aspect of diaspora here, because especially in Germany or in Europe, there's this narrative of Asians only being like Asians who are in Asia or just coming for, I don't know, for studies or traveling to Europe, and it totally makes it visible that there are Asians who are actually grew up here, who are German, who are like second or third generation as well. So this is why they decided to put the diaspora in there, and I also wanted to highlight this. So yeah, that's for the context. So the documentary was a lot about coming out to parents, and then if I remember correctly, at the last storytelling salon that Harfit here organized, you said something like that it's always hard to come out to your parents, but it's even harder when you're Asian. Could you maybe explain a bit why you think it's like that?
Did I say that? yeah, I mean, I probably said it, but, yeah, I don't know It's just hard, you know, like the responsibility you carry as a first generation migrant. You know, there's like so many expectations that are not necessarily put on you by your parents, but it's like very implicit because you grow up in some kind of community and everybody kind of expects you to go a certain way, you know, to study and to graduate and then to find a really good job and then to marry, you know, very, just a very typical way, and then having kids and then to not fulfilling all of that, and not just in that aspect of sexuality and gender, but also being like, I don't know, studying social science or I study cultural anthropology and philosophy, and it's like not a typical thing to study, you know, because all my friends, they study informatics or they study economics, and I don't know, they're all having like startup companies by now, and I'm just like, I'm in my 14th fucking semester and I haven't finished my bachelor's, so yeah, and especially as, oh yeah, by the way, I'm a first generation Vietnamese migrant, so my parents came here as guest workers. And that makes it even harder because they rely on working as their justification to exist here. And that, so choosing to study cultural anthropology in itself is already outrageous, you know? And then not being straight, not being cisgender, not fitting into all these categories, you know, makes it really hard, I think
there is, like, as Dan said, there is a certain goal that our parents had in mind that we should reach, and whatever comes in the way that makes it harder for us to reach that goal, they want to eliminate that, and being queer, not doing something seen as, like, lucrative in a matter of like that way you can own a lot of money in, or a way you can get a lot of recognition in the society. It's restraining you from being successful. And the definition of success is having a very well controlled life, and things like studying something where you don't, like, if you study cultural anthropology, or in my case, I'm studying theater science, I mean, what are your job expectations? So, and it's not like I'm going to go into some office and be there on my computer and then I clock out and I get my money and at the end of the month. It's not going to be like that. You know, I have to struggle to find a job, I have to struggle to write, I have to struggle to do everything, you know. So in my case, I come from a very privileged family where my parents are somewhat educated, and I had the privilege of, you know, explaining them that I want to do this and I am able to get my money out of this, and I am, you know, I have the talent and I can somehow make it work and make them understand. But whenever my parents that are like are talking to someone else, they don't like to talk about my education, they don't like to talk about how I'm living, my living standards, they don't like to talk about he's doing activism, like, they don't, what is that, you know, there's nothing you can grip. And being queer is something you can't ever grip. You can't put it in a marriage, you can't put it into a perspective that, you know, their friends and their families can ever understand. So that's why they're very, like, scared of that, because you can't be, you can't translate this to their kind, because it's something that's new, it's our thing, you know, and it comes together as another problem of, you know, sadly it's mostly queer people who do these alternative studies and a lot of stuff, you know, that where they go for activism because they want to be visible, I think, you know. And then when we go into also being queer and then getting out, you know, it's something they can't, like, they can't grip it. It's something, it's not explainable. So that, I think that's a very big fear of our parents, and that's why it makes us hard, because we don't want to be fearing, you know, because we are the ones who fill up their, you know, Anträge and all of it. And so, and if we take away then all of their ground, so we don't want to be responsible for that.
I studied film, obviously. And it's also not very mainstream choice of study. Well, my parents, they're cooler than what I expected. So when I said I want to go to study Beijing Film Academy, they said, yeah, go ahead. And I got in, but one of their biggest worry when I was in school was, they would say, don't just date an actress. Don't ever date or marry an actress, because they are all shameless. They could kiss someone they are really not in love with. And back then, I was saying in my heart, no, I won't, thank you. And a few years later, concretely, congratulations, and I'm actually seeing men rather than women. So I was dating actually an actor back then. Even though they were quite conservative in the beginning, but I feel very appreciated that in the end they still accepted me, even it was years of progress. But there's new questions, new problems coming all the time, just like what was told in the film. Even they accept their children, but they started to give another round of marriage pressure. And I already see the marriage equality in Taiwan is now legalized, but somehow those people will say, oh, I can just go without marriage because I was not allowed to marry it. But now a guy has a boyfriend, and they were sorry, the parents started to say, you can get married now and you should. Or the other side is the story, the narrative of having children. It's actually happening between me and my parents. They would say, it's okay for you to be gay, but you should have a child. And I heard there is someone, some way you can get it. And we can help you economically, and we can help you to raise up him or her. By the way, we don't care if it's a boy or a girl. We are not that conservative. So we need to have someone, have a child. And so this is a... this makes me feel the struggle actually never ends. And this is not only for LGBT individuals, but on this topic in China, a lot of the straight heterosexual people don't want to have kids, don't get married either. So I guess from this term, we are on the same boat. Actually, my brother, he doesn't want to get married either. And so he was complaining because he's so easy for you, you said you're gay, so you can't get married, don't mean get married. But all the pressure is on me now because I'm still heterosexual. And I was saying you can have a fake coming out. So it's easier for you.
Yes, I totally feel that. My older sister is getting married in October, and I thought, okay, now like at least one of us is getting married, then not so much pressure on me, but no. Everybody's now like, now it's your turn, you're next. Yes. So when you just said that like it's really hard for like our parents to grip this idea what queerness means, and I had to think about this podcast, it's called Nancy. And one of the podcast hosts is Taiwanese American, and she did one podcast episode where she's traveling to Taiwan with her mom, and it's like coming out over and over again because her mom just is ignoring it and not accepting it. And in Taiwan, she's like meeting different activists, and she's also meeting somebody from a hotline for parents of queer kids. And this person then told her that it's really hard to understand for parents what it really means to be queer. They don't have an idea what it means and what our lives could look like. And that's why it's really hard for them to understand. And I think this was really important lesson for me to learn, because I sometimes feel like when I talk to my parents that they should know things, they should educate themselves, they should be aware, they shouldn't use this and this words, they shouldn't like discriminate. But I actually don't take that much time to explain things to them, because of course it hurts for me, but Yeah, but still, it's a bit difficult. Do you feel like when talking to your parents that there is some way of communicating what your life looks like, that like the way you choose to live is one where you think it makes you happy and where they can accept this?
In my case, it was like when I write, I write in my mother tongue, it's Tamil, and there was a writer, she wrote about alternative livings, as in like LGBTQI issues, and then she was writing about gay people, and she's a Tamil woman, and she's not very fluent in German, as well as she's not very fluent in English, so the only way she can gather information is in Tamil, and the problem is that in Tamil, there is not much literature about these issues. So she has no chance to educate herself about it. So she picked up what she read, and then you have to send in your articles about the 12th of the month, so at the like 5th day, she calls me, I think it was 5th February or something, and she calls me and she's like, yeah, I'm going to write about this and that, and then she explains homosexuality to me, and I'm not out in the community, and I was like, okay, let's go for it. And then she explains, like, yeah, there are gay people, there are men and men living together, they get married now, because, you know, in Germany it's possible you get married, and then she's like, yeah, so they always have, like, one man who's, like, the woman, and then there is, like, another man, he's the man, and, yeah, you can always see them, the manly men, they usually don't have a beard and all that, and I'm like, okay, and then it was going on, it was getting so, like, weird and awkward, and she kept explaining, and then she said, yeah, and then there are trans people where a male person goes into a female position, and you know, whereas in like where the transsexual Indian or South Asian community is very strong, you know, they have quite the visibility, and so they made, you know, a step forward in educating straight heterosexual people, but the gay people, they don't have any visibility, so people put on stories upon you, it's ridiculous, and that's why where I was like, okay, how can I be out, you know, I live my life as I am, I told my parents, yeah, so you're not going to get me married ever, so you need to prepare for that, and that's the way I kind of out myself, you know, that's how I came out kind of, but I like struggle with the idea of explaining it to them, because I remember one day, it was a very sunny evening when I was sitting in the garden and my mom was on the phone, and then she ended the phone call and came, and we had like a little sing-song thingy in the garden, and she sat there and was like, I'm like, oh mom, what are you thinking about? She's like, yeah, I'm very glad to have healthy kids. And I'm like, okay, I'm like, why are you saying this right this moment? And she was like, yeah, I just heard that, and there's another Tamil guy who shares my name. His name is, I'm not going to say his name, but his name is very, very similar to mine. Okay, so, and he lives in Cologne. And what happened was, he outed himself to his parents, and then somebody heard about that, and the Tamil community told other Tamil people that this guy is living as a girl now. But he didn't like change his sex, he's not transsexual, but they said he's living as a girl now and with his boyfriend. And I didn't understand, I was like, I just saw him like at this gay queer party, like I didn't see him being transitioning and things, so I don't want to judge anyone's gender, but you know. And then I was like, oh, she's trying to explain that this person is gay now, because he is the female and his boyfriend should be the man, and you know, and that's how they explain a homosexual relationship between men, you know. And I was like, okay, I can't come out to this mother, how am I going to explain this, like I'm not going to be a woman soon, like I don't want any gender, so why would you want to put me into any category? So there has to be a category, somebody has to be a man and somebody has to be a woman, so if I have to, you know, I have to someday carry out a child, so how am I going to be carrying out a child, it's not going to happen, so how can I be in a relationship with a man? There is a lot of struggles that we can't explain to our parents because we ourselves don't have the energy, because we struggle a lot on our own. You know, so.
I mean, I definitely agree, like, to some point that it's really a struggle to explain certain terms and labels to our parents, I think. But then I also want to, you know, open up this this thought of, you know, somehow decolonizing the way we talk and also think. I think we're, because we grew up here mostly, we have this urge to put everything into labels that are defined here, you know, that are created here. For example, queer, you know. We don't have that in Vietnamese, for example, so we just use the English term. But then we kind of stop looking at the way Vietnamese society or other societies, for example, look at gender, you know, like the small notions of gender and sexuality in society and everyday life. And I want to give an example. For example, I came out to my parents as bisexual, and that was like a disaster. like my mom, she didn't talk to me for like half a year, and my dad, he was totally cool though. So that was like a traditional coming out, but I never talked to them about my gender actually. And I think now I kind of, yeah, I don't actually have the urge to come out to them as gender fluid, because I want to explain it a bit. Like right now I'm very feminine presenting, like very traditionally feminine presenting. So it's just very simple. Like I'm their daughter, and I'm just a girl for them, of course. But when I present very masculine, like short hair, like very, very typically masculine, then I remember like all these moments my mom treated me. For example, she says stuff like, you know, she just comes up and she just hugs me, and you know, you just have to imagine, like, I look like a boy, I look like a K-pop star, you know, like short hair, and I have my chest, like I'm wearing a binder, you know, so I pass as a guy, actually, for some occasions, and she just comes up to me, and she just says, "Đẹp trai," and that means, like, handsome boy. And that's, you know, that's a kind of acknowledgement of my gender without actually having to explain to her, like, okay, mom, I'm gender fluid, you know, non-binary, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's too complicated, and I don't have words for that in Vietnamese. But just knowing that she does see my masculinity in a certain kind of way, it's just very, very... acknowledging, yeah, it's just very, it's a really good feeling, you know. And just another situation. So it was Mother's Day, I think, and me and my brother, we went to like a Asian buffet thingy with her, and there's this old Vietnamese lady, and as we walk out, me and my brother, we walk side by side, and my mom, she walks in front of us. And then the old lady, she looks at my mom and she says, "Oh, you have two really handsome boys." And the funny thing is my mom, she goes along, you know. She goes along and she doesn't correct her. You know, and these are the kind of moments where I'm thinking, of course, not all parents are that cool in these situations, you know. But I do want to give them the credit of being able to grasp gender in a way that is not necessarily the way we do it here, you know, as in pronouns, as in actually using the so-called correct terms, you know, because I feel like we do have so much diverse history when it comes to gender. At least when I think about Southeast Asia, which has been widely erased because of colonialism.
And think about this question, and thanks both of your sharing is very is inspiring. And in China, media, Chinese government strongly censor all media about LGBT issues. So that's why in the society is very lacking of knowledge or image about topics LGBT or queer. That's why I was working on those documentaries, and so we can show them in some smaller places, a cafe or university or gallery sometimes, and we have short version to put online. And so until now, I'm very proud of those works because I meet people, and some of them heard I'm the director of the Mama Rainbow and Papa Rainbow. They will come to me and tell me that. Show to my to their parents when they come out, which help them the progress to be easier. I don't think it will really change everything, but at least they build this conversation, and it's a material they can use. At the same time, I as someone grew up in China. Actually, in the history of China, there are a lot of stories regarding queer or homosexuals. So, but those stories was mostly erased from our textbook, and also there were little openly published book will talk about them, and people forget. So most of the term we are using on queer or LGBT issues are still translated from European or American terms. But I feel this kind of invisible, among all those things, invisibility, there is still some something going bandits underneath of the society. For example, when I came out to my parents, my dad was he was light on a cigarette, and he was thinking, oh, I don't know what he was thinking. He suddenly told me, well, you said you are gay, but why didn't you see other gay people in this village where I grew up? I just told my dad, well, there must be, but there was only a few choices. Either people like me, I know that I won't have good life in staying here, so I study hard to go to Beijing, to go to big cities, find another future of mine. And the other option is if you stay here, you probably need to get into a heterosexual marriage. And he said, wait a minute, I have a friend. He is married to a woman, but he doesn't want to have sex with her, and he always do something very, very feminine. He loves making clothes, and he always go to bath house. And could he be gay? And I said, oh, Dad, I didn't know you have such a friend. And he sounds very gay. And do you want me to live like him? And my dad said no. Then he already know. He among those was invisible of LGBT, but he can see when you tell him the story, he can put that image into one person, which is make me think also the blurry between visible and invisible. And another thing is what I was thinking then those history being erased because partly also because of the colonialism's history, and even all those political correctness is still giving influence to the Chinese society. I see the positive side, but also because you know. In Chinese we don't have gender pronouns. Oh God! So I'm learning German, so you can imagine how hard it is for me to remember everything. Why they have why a chair is a male and a bottle is female. So it's still so painful for me because it's almost the opposite of German. But I remember when me and my friend, we were talking about another friend of us and in Chinese, and then suddenly a professor, she speaks very good Chinese, and she tried to correct us. So we were saying, we were using the term ta, and she suddenly said, no, this is tamen, because the person you're talking is gender queer, so you should not use ta. And I was almost saying fuck you, fuck off. But the friend who was talking with me, he said, no, don't do that, because he writes a reference, his friend, the famous professor, he wrote the reference later, that's why I got the job. But he explained to her clearly, so because in Chinese, this doesn't make sense if you, it's like we're saying you take off your pants to fart. When you speaking Chinese and describe someone genderqueer, but using tamen, because tamen is only for plural for more than one person. But ta, because in Chinese, he and she, the writing is different, but the pronunciation is the same. Actually, also same for animal. Also now it's a trend that when we write about genderqueer person, we use the English character ta, ta, instead of the writing female and male. And he was very pretentious about that. But for that moment, I feel just totally pissed off. You colonized our language, even with your language, which is super not cool, not generally cool. I was pissed off.
Also in my culture, it was very interesting that we didn't have male and female. It's like in the Vedic time, that's where Hinduism comes from. Separated people, or like separated, that was what we call gender today, in ages. So it was like ripe age, so when you could get kids, and when you had your puberty, that was one gender, and when you were a baby, that was one gender. So they didn't like gender people from, you know, what you had between your legs, but from the ages. So that was very interesting. But if you ask like very, very literate people about that now, they don't know about it, because everything is, you know, deleted and diluted, and they don't care and they don't know. And if you ask them, like, you know, have you ever considered that this happened in our culture? And they'll be like, no, that can't be true. Like, how did they do that? It's not possible, you know, because you're so deeply colonized in that ideas.
So you mentioned that in Taiwan, same-sex marriage is legal now, I think, since the 24th of May, so it's just a few days. And at the day where the Taiwanese parliament voted on same-sex marriage, the president, Tsai Ing-wen, wrote on Twitter, quote, "Today we have the chance to make history and show the world that progressive values can take root in East Asian society." And I was actually quite annoyed that she wrote this, because I feel like she's framing like acceptance of like queer people or queer rights as something that is inherently a Western concept, and that Asian countries' progressiveness is measured by this Western standard. And even though there's like this huge variety of different gender expressions and sexual orientations, we had like before Asia was colonialized, and like most of the anti-queer laws that still exist today in Asia were all imposed by colonial rule. So my question is, do you see legalizing same-sex marriage as an act of decolonization, or do you think that maybe we as part of diaspora and kind of in the tradition of post-colonial thinking are reading too much into it? Do you think like this like conversation like this is happening in like these countries as well?
Like, I know for certain that it's happening in India very much. I don't know about Sri Lanka, because Sri Lanka has a lot of other problems. But in India, I know that it happens, and you know, we like Sri Lanka or Tamil people a lot. They like to take India as an example for a lot of things. So the LGBTQI India community in India is not like very visible in Europe and in the Western society, but inside India, they're isolated, but they're very much visible. and they do a lot of things and they do have talks, and I also like watch a lot of documentaries where it's authentic documentaries, not like where white people go and do that. It's like where they did their own movies about homes for LGBTQI people, and where they when they had like certain pairs where they were making them able to go with foreign passports, you know, get married, and you know that's still happening. And now they don't, like, if you want to get married, you could do that, but you know, if you had to flee, they were like contacting embassies in Europe, and you know, they had a lot of very well established infrastructures where they could do that. And so I think it happens, but it's like still something that we look down on, you know, as in like they have these small movements, but in these countries with the legislative things they have there, it's like huge steps that they do, and it's very hard for them, you know. There are like not just you know, like in Germany you can't attack LGBTQI institutions openly, you know, with firebombs, or you know, you can't set them on fire, you can't go there and throw acid on people in Germany, you know, they can't come here and do that, you know. But in India or Sri Lanka, all these countries, it's normal, you know. If LGBTQI people meet somewhere, they will set things on fire, they will come and, you know, beat people up, and still they do that, you know. This is like, it's like rich people who, you know, are gay, they give other LGBTQI people their houses to live in, you know. They have like big, big, big bungalows where they say, okay, let's just make this a camp for the people who get their visas to fly the next day or something, or they make up like small little LGBTQI embassies in houses and like private homings where like there's like a huge family coming together, you know. And I think also it's always a matter of family perspectives in these things, because in Germany I feel like, okay, we are all LGBTQI people and we have other aspects that bound us together as being Asian or, you know, being people of color, but it's still something we're very much isolated in our own. But there, it's a lot of like, you know, they have to stay together, because when you go out alone, you're very vulnerable. So they have a lot, like, you know, in these transgender communities, they have like moms, you know, who like all this mother culture that you see on Pose, and which was established in New York and everywhere. We also have that, and I think we might have that before you guys. So, you know, it all happened. You know, there's like this conversation of buying a kid, and then you have to pay back, you know, because your mom spent so much money on making you feminine, buying you clothes, and you know, caring for you, buying you food, and you know, getting you a job, and then you have to pay your mother back in order to go live your own life or go build your own house or something, you know. And we also have that, and these conversations are real. And I can speak for India because that's what I, you know, see there. And in my own motherland, as they call it, it's still something that's not very visible there. And I try to speak to a lot of LGBTQI people, and they just are not visible, because in like Sri Lankan government is very harsh on queer issues. Yeah. I think India is a very good example.
I think I'm actually split. I feel like in the case of Vietnam, it's very, I feel like the legal situation is not as important as kind of working on the stigma in society. Because I don't know, it's just like you have a very corrupt regime, and changing the legal situation kind of shows to the Western world that, okay, we're progressing somehow. And that's definitely important, just for the country's image in a way. But then if I look at Vietnamese society, it's still very, yeah, it's just very stigmatized, just like homosexuality. Like it's accepted in certain ways and areas, but I feel like the legal situation doesn't change that, unfortunately.
I agree with Dan. it's always a puzzle that we want to change the stigma of the society, and actually the law could if we don't have the law to protect us, it's we don't change the censorship, it's hard to change it. But if the community is still very stigmatized and it's hard to change the law, so it's always difficult what to insert, where to start. I'm mostly positive. See the law in Taiwan, the change of the law in Taiwan positively. Well, I also have my concern. One of the things is I see the why this change happened at this moment, and how do politicians use it, and how people read about it. Actually, there is a phenomenon of nationalism behind. So when they were saying we are the first in Asia, of course. But I think well, because it's special international situation, this Taiwanese nationalism is the existing is very necessary, because they want to be an independent country, but they don't have it in a lot of time. It's much, much better than Chinese nationalism, but it's also still nationalism, we should be aware of. And look at the worst example is the pink wash in Middle East, in how it, what Israeli government use it. I don't think it will be that worse, but we should always be aware of it. And secondly, there is one phenomenon that a lot of people think of marriage equality we have, then we are there. But we are there, where is there? When the federal government does recognize sex marriage in the US, and I see so many cheers on Facebook, but I just said something against it. I didn't remember what did I said, but it totally make my Facebook to be a disaster that days, and some of my friends just unfriend me and block me. So they because they think this is something we have been trying to achieve, our achievement is there. But to look at the U.S. The USA in these days, and what is going on, and even abortion could be that hard for, and it was made to be illegal for so many states, and of course, these are not the same group of people who was fighting for it, but it is a certain conservative trend into the society, and a lot of queer people, they don't care anymore, because they think, oh, that's not my issue, women's issue is not my issue, because I'm white gay man and I can get married, I can adopt children, and so then they lost this this strength to continue to fight.
I mean, I do think that is also maybe the difference becomes clear between so-called, you know, Western countries and, you know, Asian countries. It's like Western countries are very focused on the individual, so they rely very much on the legal situation, you know. While that is not that crucial for Asian societies, I think. Because just in general, if we look at how societies work, there's so many things that might be illegal, but people work around it, you know, and kind of still make their way, which can be called like corruption in some way. But then also on a small level, when it comes to family, and there's just a whole setup that people need to deal with, which is way more important than being recognized legally. More important is that your family recognizes you, that you function in this kind of hierarchy, that you're saving the face, which is tragic, unfortunately, you know. But that's so much more important than being recognized by a state, something very abstract. So, yeah, I don't know, that's just, I'm repeating, it's not that important, I think.
I think it also goes along with why a lot of states did not accept, like, why there is still a death sentence for people getting into same-sex relations. Because they don't, like, it's like widely seen as not appropriate, and these people are seen as not important anyway, you know, they're second-grade citizens. So why would we go into, you know, adjust our jurisdiction for them? So, like, the thing is that they don't think that we're important enough, so that's why they don't do anything that's, you know, helping us anyway. That's, you know, something that goes along, you know, there's like both sides, and we have to elevate like the society standards in order to see more happening in the states, you know, otherwise, because if you don't elevate society standards in terms of, you know, being more friendly towards LGBTQI issues, you don't have any thing with any kind of, oh yeah, now you can get married, but we still hate you, so.
Okay, let's take some questions from the audience. I saw people writing stuff down, so maybe there are questions.
Thank you everybody for your views. It's super interesting to listen to you all. And thank you Popo for your amazing reviews. I would like to go back to finding a common language, because I remember, and like, our parents not understanding, or the notion that our parents don't understand the notion of queerness. You know, I did a podcast episode where we were just like, oh, he's like stumbling around with like academic stuff, and my mom didn't understand anything, which might be a good thing, but then again, I want her to understand. And I think what's so important is that the process of decolonizing is also part of finding a common language with our parents. If you are in the in the situation where you can out yourself, and when you can come out, so finding a common language with parents and generations that don't have access to academic concepts like queerness, and how queerness evolved. I wouldn't say queerness is an academic concept, but the way we talk about, or the tools we are given, is kind of academic these days, I think, and how we can do that if we're in a situation where we can come out to our parents. And I think what the examples that Fran and Dan said already were great, that you just don't name it, or with the words you frame it with like how we do it in this round maybe, or something like, how can we find more of a common language to make decolonization practical and part of our everyday lives with our families.
I mean, I think that's also like an alternative to the traditional, you know, very white coming out. Because I feel like all the narrative that exists about coming out is just very white, you know, like you sit down with your parents and you have a real talk and then it's done. You know, that's not how we do things, like never ever. Like, we don't even, you know, like the very typical example in Asian societies, we don't say like, I love you, you know, like, but we ask like, have you eaten, you know, and then you just need to translate to all the other situations in life. We don't have to have this directness, and I think understanding our own cultures, our parents, helps us to take off this pressure maybe, to have this kind of traditional coming out.
Yeah, I really liked what they did in the documentary, that they have an event that was for kids and their parents. And that's, I think that's a thing that we don't have here in Germany, because it's always like, I don't know, it's different. I think it's really different for white Germans to come out to their parents. because like, when you do that and your parents are Asian, it's more like, yeah, it's like everybody gets involved. It's not like your own thing, because like you're talking about your own sexuality or your own gender, so it's actually your own thing, but for your family it's not. It's like everybody's concern. And I think that really makes it different. And I really wish there would be something like a camp where we can send our parents to educate themselves, queer stuff. That would be really great.
I also think it's very beautiful how they did that in the movie. But it's also like
not just about a common language, but also a common ground, because for our parents, when I talk to my parents about decolonializing their brains, they'll be like, well, it's your job, you know, because we can't afford to decolonize. We were raised that way. And you have the freedom, because you live in Germany, you can say what you want. But I don't have that, because when I tell my mom, mom, when somebody sees your face and asks you if you're able to speak German, be rude to them. And she's like, no, they don't know, because I don't look German, and she's fine with it. And you know, we have to shift that ground to somewhere else, you know, because that's where we have to call, like, decolonialize as well. And they're like, yeah, but you can afford to say no, because this is your country and all that, you know. And that's why they're like, they leave the job for us to decolonialize, and we have to, like, shift the ground to, yeah, it's also your job to, you know, make our ways safer for decolonializing. And I think with the idea that came in the movie, we might get like boasting things together. I hope someday, you know, I'd be in for some projects.
So regarding to your question, I think one thing is where is the common language? I believe one of the common language is story. No matter what kind of cultural background or education parents or other people have, we all know stories. We all heard stories, and with story we can put our image in, into it. So I still believe the power of storytelling, so that's why I will continue my filmmaking. And second is community, as both of you that in the film they organize this community meeting, and it's not only I have been seeing how they grew up these years. In 2008, when I first time went to their conference, there was only two parents, Ken, and the second year there were maybe four or five, and there are more and more parents coming, but they are crying. And after the conference, there was so many tissues on the ground. And I was even think of collecting them and make them into an installation. But then when it keep on going, and they were more laughing rather than crying. Or people come here with tear and leave with smiling or laughing. So it changed really a lot. There is also this could be also disaster, because sometimes they were already only the parents were meeting with each other, they were happy, but they already arranged their children to meet each other and try to arrange them to date. But this this is happening, and now that I think the members has been hundreds thousands of them all over the country, not only from those physical space meeting, but also they have a huge online network, online community. So people, because some of them live very far away in northwest China, so it's very expensive to travel for them to travel to Guangzhou or to Shanghai to attend the conference, but they could have just online some apps you can attend the conference from the internet, so people feel each other. Even sometimes they really meet in person, and they will say, "Wow, we have been talking." Like there is one mom talked with another mom already for a year and times, and they have been in a pair of own therapy, but they meet, and I think this kind of community is beautiful. And today, obviously share the common language, because they are from the same generation, they have the similar situation with their difficult relationship with their kids, and I feel when after I was out to my parents, we can talk a lot more than before. So we talk about sex, and this usually didn't happen when I was in closet before them. So just open up both of our life.
I think there was another question.
I'm not sure if it's a question.
I wanted to come back to what we were speaking about before as well, when Kuzo, you talk about finding a common language. When I heard that, I had a bit of a problem with it, and then I liked the way Ram, you spoke about finding a common ground. And I think that there's this concept of ways in which some literature on how like South Asian women maneuver through ambivalent spaces within families to negotiate the question of marriage and stuff like that. And I was thinking about these spaces of ambivalences, and I also was thinking about, kind of in the example that Dan, you gave as well, the power of silence as well. And I think finding these commonalities within these different silences speaks so much how. So when I think of even my parents with the kind of, let's say, the backdrop of being a part of the hegemonic white racist British society, living in a council estate in a BNP area of London, and that was there was so much silence going on, and then kind of the silences that I had to reflect upon, and thinking that I'm silenced, but there's, you know, these kind of different forms of silences that we've gone through generationally. I just kind of wanted to that kind of bring that in as something that I've kind of reflected on more, that's then not said, and what kind of this trauma that then is carried through different generations. I don't know, I just want to kind of bring that in a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Western society mostly relies on, you know, like explicitly saying everything.
Yeah.
And doesn't have a kind of this kind of sensitivity to silence and what it means.
Yeah.
And I think the way we grow up here has made us maybe numb to this kind of silence, you know, understanding our parents' silence also, you know, because they choose when they are silent, you know, and it always means something. It's not like they don't say anything, but this silence does say a lot, actually.
I don't know, it's interesting. Completely go along. Yeah. That's also like, it's very, I don't like, because my sister, she grew up more German than me. She had more German friends, went to a more Germanly popular school. And for her, it's very hard to accept that silence, you know? And she wants to hear it, yeah, like, I'm okay with you doing this, this and that. I'm like, no, you know, because it's very hard to be silent as well. It's very hard to not say something, to not hurt someone. And we have to acknowledge that a lot, you know, and that's what we miss a lot. And that's like also their alternative forms of living with queerness of other people. And if they do not talk about queerness, it's also like, you know, we see it as being ignorant about something or not thinking about it or just isolating yourself. Like, it's also accepting. It's just, you have to, you know, name it as like accepting a lot of times.
More questions?
I really like the discussion about pronoun thing in China, because that's something I personally struggle with a lot as someone who's trans and genderqueer, what kind of pronouns I should use for myself. And I was wondering, in the film, because the pronunciation is always the same, how you decided, especially in regards to the trans children, how to translate those pronouns into English, because I saw sometimes you used he or she or the written TA, and yeah, just wanted to ask about that.
So it's a lot of the different concern, and firstly regarding to transgender and gender pronouns, really I respect to their choice. So if the person is a trans man, like the son of Papa Zhao's, so it should be K. But in the beginning of the interview, we won't keep it as like a later on story, according to the storytelling, because it was not told until when he talked about that. So we still used the she at that point. And then until when he talked about it, and he was, it's kind of his identity was out. So we used the he at that point. But we had consulted the person himself, And he agreed with that. He's okay with that. So that's why we made this decision. But for Quanjie, so the trans woman, so we always use she, and she's gender fluid. So we asked in English what to use, and she said use she. So that's how we decided. So from the political identity and also the concern on cinematic issue. So that was, but usually in Chinese is I feel it's quite I feel really really lucky to speak this language, because when he say someone and when we say someone, it's just pronounce, we don't need to think that much. And in our mind, because in Chinese we could talk about someone, oh, someone is so hot, blah blah blah, I want to meet that person, blah blah blah. We could talk about hours, and we don't know the gender of the person. Sometimes you make some jokes, like we were talking about maybe a guy, and he has heterosexual. Male friend of mine, someone had a big crush on him. He was like, yeah, I want to meet that person, blah, blah, blah. And until the, and we talk about very long, and what does that person do, where is the person live, and blah. And then my friend suddenly realized, oh, by the way, is that a guy or a girl? And you should know that I'm talking about a guy. I was like, okay, sorry, I don't need to meet him. So. But this joke also beautiful, because you don't need to think about the gender when you it's just an individual, it's just a person, it's just a human.
So yeah, it's already late, so I only have one last question for you, and this is what are you currently working on? What are your projects? Is there something that you want to raise awareness for, or where you want to support for, or do you have some events in the future planned?
I am not working on projects at the moment. I'm just looking for a job.
Hey, Vera.
A student job. If you know anything, call at me. No, at the moment I'm just writing putting out a lot of stuff on Instagram. If you want to follow me, Vertigo XOXO.
Yeah.
Like a lot of, you know, mental health, sex positive.
Yeah, so I'm working on that common brand thing actually, because I was invited to some I spoke to banners about it, because in Aachen University, like we all these Tamil people, they have little student groups, and they form some, you know, occasions where they get someone to speak and all that, and they had this feminist community week or something, and they were, you know, they were really actually tokening, but they didn't know that they were tokening, so they had this trans person, this trans woman, this girl who married a guy who was 18 years older than her, and then, you know, they gathered everyone who's living somewhat alternatively than a normal, like, traditional Tamil person who's very well seen in the society, and they were also asking me to come. And, you know, why were they asking me? Because I might represent some LGBTQI minority in the community, you know? So now I'm like, okay, there's some talking happening here, because I was checking who else is coming. And they wanted me to talk about, you know, what the perception of femininity is. And they were saying really, really problematic things, and that's where I gathered the information that also our young people, our second generation, our first generation childs who were born to immigrant parents, they do not know a lot about, first of all, our culture, ourselves, and also our ways of alternative living, because they're thinking in a very Eurocentric way. And I'm trying to find this, I'm just looking a lot, I'm just trying to gather everyone and see how they think, because I really want to like do something to educate them that it's okay to be still, you know, Asian and still be alternative. You don't have to be this out Asian who's living in this way, or you have to be the Asian German or someone, yeah? So that's really hard to find the common ground, and I'm trying to find that.
In Germany, I have a few public events in the next few days. One is on June 5th. I have a lecture at University der Kunst in Berlin, Udifan. And if you have friends in Berlin, can tell them. And on 7th, I have a panel in Short Film Festival Hamburg, talking about censorship. And then in the end of June, I'm going to USA for two film festivals. It's a Palm Springs Short Film Festival and the Frontline San Francisco LGBT Film Festival to premiere a new short movie I made last year in China about a very unique topic about fetish, but fetish on teeth. And happened between two guys in China, reflecting the urban loneliness. Oh my god, it sounds so complicated already. Yeah. And I'm also preparing, I just wrote a new script, and I'm planning to shoot this autumn. And this time it was in, all the dialogue are in German. So, and it's about hookup and philosophy. So it's about Wender and Hegel. So, it will be fun. And this summer I have two trips, one in China to do a video making workshop for young queer people in Beijing. And, then I'm flying to Colombia, Bogota, for the queer film festival there. I'm going to create a film series on queer migrants in Berlin, because my trip was sponsored by the Goethe Institute. So, and I realized it's a privilege to be German. So, and I'm also looking forward to that. So that's, and since this April, I created a film series on queer Chinese at a space in Waiting, Beijing, called Berlin. in Berlin called Bivak, and we had really great cooperation, and we are talking about another round of the film theory. It will be Chinese and Turkish crossover program next year, so we are showing different topics, both happens in China and Turkey, and have a series of screening, so you will see that. Please follow up. Thank you.
I just quickly want to use the opportunity to also like promote one of my things. So as Kusuke already mentioned, we are doing a podcast together. It's called Diaspora Asia Podcast, where we talk about Asian German identities, stories of the diaspora, mental health, queer struggles, and so on. And on the 1st of June, we're having our first anniversary. So we're doing this for 1 year. And yeah, we also think that the power of telling stories is so important, so we're doing a storytelling event. We are telling some stories, and also like Ash and Harper, who are sitting over there, are also going to do some beautiful stuff. I'm super excited for it. So it's the 1st of June at Internationales Zentrum. You can all come. There will be food, lots of fun.
What time?
It starts at 7. Over there is also a poster. You can take a picture of the poster and you have all the info. And of course, you can find it on Facebook, Instagram, and so on. Okay, that's it. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.